Those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. There is much in the history of food from which we can learn. Question is, can we learn from that history? Or are we, as Santayana suggests, doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 719th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or perhaps you're among our friends down there in Todos Santos who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Folks, agriculture led to the growth and development of ancient civilizations that were very great indeed, including the Sumerians of the Golden Triangle, the Egyptians of the Nile, Chinese of the Yellow River, Bantus of the African Plains, and Mayans of the Yucatan Peninsula. But along the way, something went wrong with those agricultures, and the great civilizations of the ancients collapsed and pretty much just disappeared. So today we pause to ask, why did agriculture fail? Was the cause something really obvious like running out of water? Or was it something more subtle like the salinization of the soil? How does modern agriculture differ from those ancient agricultures? You know, the natural laws that govern growth and development of plants have always remained the same. What then is the difference between the agriculture of the ancients and the agriculture of today? And can modern agriculture allow us to escape the fate of the ancients? If we remember what happened to them, can we avoid that and survive with our civilization intact? Well, here to help us cultivate some answers on these wonderful questions, we have the return of Thomas and Carol Sinclair, co-authors of Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change, Agriculture's Imprint on World History. Welcome, Tom and Carol, back to the Food Chain. Been a whole week since we spoke.
Good morning.
Good to have you aboard. You're a husband and wife team that put together this wonderful look back in history at the history of our agriculture, Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change. And if folks out there want to learn more about the two of you, they can tune into last week's edition of the Food Chain, which is number 718 on the web at metrofarm.com, and get a quick background of you. So I'd like to really jump right in quickly and look at those great civilizations, so kind of a quick thumbnail of them and talk about why their agricultures failed. So, Thomas, you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Can I barely hear you? Can you speak up or...
Pretty loud, okay.
Okay, I can hear you a little bit better now.
Okay.
Let's see. Maybe I'll turn it up here. Okay. Sumerians of the Golden Triangle. Of course, we all know that the Golden Triangle, the Tigris and Euphrates River and the plains between them are pretty much the birthplace of agriculture as we know it today and the birthplace of a great Sumerian civilization. Thomas, what happened to that agriculture that caused it to fail?
Well, they were irrigating. They had to irrigate mainly out of the Euphrates River, and all irrigation water has salts in it. And if you irrigate long enough without flushing your soil, the salts accumulate. And basically, that's what appears to happen to Sumerians. And they, when the field starts accumulating salt, they move further north. And eventually, along the Euphrates River, and eventually they came in contact or conflict with the Akkadians, and the Akkadians defeated them militarily. But the root cause was the salinization of their soil.
But Thomas, when we talk about salt in this respect, are we talking about sodium chloride?
In most cases, yes. But salts are any of the ions. So if you have heavy accumulation of other ions, they can also cause the problem.
For example?
Well, you can, some rarely do you have potassium. You can have some calcium problems, but again, those are usually pretty small. It's almost always the sodium that's the problem.
Fair enough. Carol, let's go to the Egyptians of the Nile. What a wonderful civilization that agriculture spawned, made possible, of course, by the annual floods of the Nile replenishing the soil, and also helped along by the fact that the desert really kind of protected the civilization as well. But something happened there. What happened?
Well, I think the Egyptians suffered from too much good luck. They were able to produce huge quantities of grain. The river helped them to do this in a very efficient way. I don't want to say leisurely because it was hard work, but they had periods of time during the year when there was little agricultural work that needed to be done. They had time for monument building, pyramids, and but the problem is when any society becomes so obviously lucky, so obviously wealthy, there are going to be other societies looking at them and trying to take advantage of them. And perhaps the Egyptians were just a little too close to Rome, a little too close to Athens. And these civilizations wanted the grain that they produced.
And simply went about taking it, right?
That's right. That's right.
And it's amazing to consider, to contemplate exactly how much spare time the Egyptians had. You know, one need only look at the wonderful monuments and the tombs and the wonderful cities that they built. So, and that's one thing food gives a civilization is time. If you don't have enough food, then you don't have any time. It's as simple as that. And obviously, the Egyptians had lots of time. Then, which of course was made them so attractive that they fell under the sway of the Greece and Rome, and actually they became the breadbasket of those civilizations. Did they not?
Certainly, is one of them. I mean, the Greeks used them, and the areas around the Black Sea were quite productive. The eastern or western shores of the Black Sea. So that was especially crucial for the Greeks to be able to bring grain from the Black Sea, and that of course you had to protect those trading routes. And we can talk later. That was the problem the Greeks had later on, is protecting those trade routes.
Mm-hmm. And then the Chinese also were victims of their own success, but in a different sort of way. Correct, Tom?
Yes, they well, their agriculture was successful and able to form the area into the consolidated into China. But the rulers got a little too greedy and taxed the population heavily, the farmers, and they also used farmers to do monument work when they didn't have time to leave the fields, really. So they really put the peasants in a terrible way. And after a while, in fact, the peasants revolted, and that was the collapse of the Han Dynasty in China.
So it's interesting to note that in your tale, Beer or Bread, Beer and the Seeds of Change, you talk about how they were so successful at producing enough food that the government started bringing in all kinds of new people into the government.
Well, that's right. I mean, they had time, or the people in the government had time to create a civilization or a culture which had many accomplishments and many things to offer, but
they had to be paid for, correct?
Yeah, they overstepped what their resources would allow.
Now, good thing we don't have anything like that going on around these days, correct?
Oh, that's for sure.
Carol, take us to the Bantus. We didn't get a chance to really talk about the Bantus of the African plain, but I never did consider the Bantus to be a great agricultural civilization. What was I missing?
Well, unfortunately, we suffer from a Western bias that has led us to not fully appreciate the advances in civilization that were made in Africa. I'm a big fan of Jared Diamond's book, Gun, Germs, and Steel, but in the case of the Bantu, I think it's one case where he just got it exactly wrong. He flat out
stated. Can you hold that? We have to take
sure.
a quick break. Jared Diamond is wrong, and we're going to find out why with respect to the Bantus of Africa and you. What do you think, folks? Can our modern agriculture save us from the sins of the past and so that our civilization, great as it is, can go on and on forever and ever? Possible? What do you think? That's the subject today as we talk with the authors, Thomas and Carol Sinclair of Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change, Agriculture's imprint on world history, and it is have a big impact. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. We're traveling to Africa, ancient Africa, to look at the civilization of the great Bantus with Carol and Thomas Sinclair, authors of Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change. Carol, Jared Diamond said something that was wrong about the civilization of the Bantus. What was that?
Of their accomplishments. At one point, I believe he states that nothing of permanent value came out of Africa, and this just obviously is not true. He's judging it by Western standards. They didn't build pyramids or other monuments that lasted, but they were very advanced. They reached the Iron Age before the Europeans did. What they didn't need to do was to organize militarily and fight their neighbors. They were able to spread and assimilate neighboring societies peacefully, and that doesn't make for real exciting history, I guess.
No, I guess not. Nothing to get excited about over there
yeah.
other than peace, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the crucial point that Jared Diamond missed was that they did have sorghum and millet that they could grow all the way down the east side of Africa, and that allowed them to expand when they exhausted the nutrients in the soil in 2 or 3 years. They just moved on. Yeah, so they covered more land area as a society than any other ones are really talking about.
Then what happened?
Well, they didn't have to militarily defend themselves. So when eventually the Europeans, of course, came in, and that was colonized Africa. But the culture of the Bantu is still the historical basis for much of the cultures in the east part of Africa.
So the culture's still there, then. The civilization still exists as it is.
That's right. The people studied languages, for instance, all the different languages in Africa, and they can trace them essentially back to a common Bantu language.
Wow. So the Bantus essentially absorbed Africa.
Most of it, yeah. The savanna lands on the east side, they started out in the Great Lakes area, what we call Lake Victoria, Lake Tanganyika, and then moving south to northern South Africa.
Okay, and then across the ocean to the Yucatan and the Mayan popular civilization. Carol?
Let me. I looked at that more
okay.
than she did.
It's Tom then. All right.
Yes. Let me. The Maya, of course, they had maize, which is a wonderful crop for high production and a good starch product that you can distill. And as their population grew, they had started out with terracing land. And then they developed this technique of growing crops in the lowlands. They built beds that they could grow the maize on and their beans. And in the wet season, then the lowlands would fill with water, and the crops would really grow quite well. These beds were organic matter, so they had plenty of nutrients. And the leaders of the Maya assumed the role of gods of bringing the rains. And what happened to them is eventually there was a climate change or intervals of drought, and these intervals of drought coincide exactly with disappearances of various societies. There were three periods of drought, and it appears the Maya, when their gods, that is their leaders, could no longer deliver rain, they just kind of drifted away, and that was basically collapse.
Yeah, who needs a god that can't bring the rain, right?
Yeah, that's
right. It seems like the Mayans then really centralized their civilization around these principles who could deliver the rain.
That's for sure.
And then when the gods couldn't deliver, then things just fell apart mightily.
And the interesting thing is they had a climate with a rainy season and a dry season, so the rainy seasons when you grow your crops and everything. Then you had a dry season of about 4 months, and we can see what you do with a population when you have a dry season. They're not growing crops. They also were put to building pyramids.
Right. Then the two of you are looking back in history, but you're also very much focused in your day-to-day lives on improving the growth and productivity of our crops. So you have this interesting perspective that's really attractive to us who don't have that focus. How have the natural laws of plant growth and development changed over the millennium, Thomas?
Well, plants are plants, and there's not been any change of laws or thermodynamics or physics that would give us any greater growth. The things we've done in modern society and actually the progress in technology in history in the last 200 or 300 years has been to give plants more of the resources they need, the main one being the nitrogen fertilizer, mm-hmm. and selecting plants that have an ability to absorb that nitrogen and use it effectively in growing grain.
Well, the development of this modern technology really started, what, back in the Roman Empire?
Well, there's certainly features of it, probably in the Holy Roman Empire, beginning about 1000 CE was when we started seeing some technological developments. Up till then, most of the labor was done by human muscle,
right,
in agriculture, and at that point, people started using animals, oxen, to pull plows. The soils in Europe demanded they have more strength and muscles than the human muscle. And one of the interesting things is the oxen are a little bit awkward to turn around, for instance. So in many places in Europe, the fields were just really long and narrow. If you travel in Poland, you'll still see the fields are 30 or 40 feet wide and run, whatever, a mile long, and that's from the days when you had oxen.
So you can look at those fields and realize that it was all because of the oxen had a poor turning radius.
That's right.
And
they couldn't use horses because the oxen yoke that they put on choked the horses, and so they couldn't use horses. And it was only a little bit later in that period when they came up with a collar that we're familiar with that put the stress on the shoulders. They put it around the shoulders of the horse, that then the horse could be used. But the horse, you know, is a very hungry animal, and they could only use the horse to really pull carts. They still wouldn't be used in the field.
So their animals introduced a whole new thing to agriculture, which is saving a little bit of human labor and putting it on the shoulders of animals. But it also introduced another thing about this new technology, is that you had to pay for it, right?
Well, you had to be able to feed the animals if you're going to have them, and put another burden on. And still in the Middle Ages, there wasn't that much spare. The horses needed grain. You didn't have grain to feed a lot of horses, so they still weren't a major factor. The oxen, you could let them forage for themselves in the woodlands.
Because they're ruminants, right?
Yeah.
They could eat grasses and get by. So that oxen became the most important thing. So animals was the first major breakthrough then. What else?
Talk about the hops. They started doing a bit of a rotation. Actually, the Romans recommended it, but as far as we can tell, they probably never did it. But they had a two-field rotation. So one year they would grow their grains in one field and just let the other field idle. And this allowed the natural nutrient cycle to operate in that second field and leave a little bit of extra nitrogen for when they went into the crop the following year.
Because unlike the Bantus, there was not the Great Plains of Africa to keep on moving on, right? So they're stuck in one place, and they have to figure out how to make one place work on a continued basis. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're looking at the technologies of agriculture way back to the beginnings of civilization, working our way rapidly forward to modern times. What is the difference between the technology of the ancients and the technologies of today? And can the technologies of today allow us to escape the mistakes of the ancients? Right back. Welcome back, and we are looking back, way back, to the beginnings of civilization and the history of agriculture, and how agriculture made possible the spawning of great civilizations, and then the collapse of that agriculture led to the collapse of those civilizations, because without food, there is no civilization, and that's about as simple as that. So we're looking at the development of modern agriculture, which kind of took place at the that way back in the Holy Roman Empire, when they started using animals, draft animals, to help plow the fields, and how they started using crop rotations. When did we start using metals, Thomas?
Well, the metals are pretty old, actually. In fact, it goes back to the beginning. The Sumerians had put some iron on the tips of their plows, or hoes, really. The Bantu had iron-tipped digging sticks. So metal's been there for most of the time.
Good. So when it came time to plow with draft horses, we're talking about really turning some soil then.
Yes, that was a change. But got to remember, that really only occurred only about 250 years ago when a surplus of grain could be produced to feed these horses.
And it was a surplus of grain that really made it possible. How did they come up with the surplus then?
This is an agricultural issue, so I'll go into it a bit.
Okay.
It really began with the yields of that two-field rotation I was talking about were low. They were terribly low compared to modern production, eighth of a ton per hectare, which would be 10% of what we'd like to get now. And the Dutch, who were in their golden age, decided that cheese production is something they wanted to do, and they developed a rotation to have a lot of pasture time for their cows. The British saw that and brought it to Britain and introduced a four-crop rotation, and the key of it was a pasture which included legume, the clover, which fixed atmospheric nitrogen into the soil, and after two or three years of the pasture, they would plow it, they could grow the wheat, then they could also in that cycle grow oats and turnips, of course wheat and barley, oats and turnips which could be used to feed the horses.
Mm-hmm.
So that including the rotation took yields up to about 2 tons per hectare, more than a doubling of yields.
So we're starting to get smart about this, aren't we?
Well, That's the beginning of the scientific revolution, really. We can look at these things and start understanding and making progress in this technology.
Mm-hmm. And from the crop rotations and the use of legumes, what came next?
In Britain, that was pretty well it. They contributed the rotations. So,
well, one thing that happened in Britain was, as these fields became more productive, as you were working to protect the fertility of the field, you became possessive of what you had given added value to the field.
And so we're going to be talking about the rule of law then.
Yes, we're talking about the Enclosure Acts when the society did a turnabout and said, well, the small landholder could no longer just send his sheep out to graze wherever they found something good to eat. Now, this is my field, and I'm going to plant hedges around it or build stone walls around it, and your sheep can't come in here to eat. This drove many of the marginal producers off the land. They could no longer afford to stay on the land. You had the doubling of yield, which meant you really only needed half the number of farmers that you had before. And it coincided with the time of the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So you had people being driven off the land. They went to the cities. The cities is where the new factories were being built, and they were looking for a labor force. Unfortunately, the labor force that they needed was a bit different than the agricultural labor force. As we talked about last week, people had been drinking large quantities of beer from the beginning of humankind.
Bread and beer, right?
That's right. Well, beer and moving equipment don't go together very well. And it may be that the factory owners weren't particularly interested in the safety of their employees. They were very interested in the safety of their machines, and they didn't want a bunch of drunks throwing a monkey wrench into the machine. This caused a big movement to get people off of alcohol, to get them sober, and the beginning of the temperance movement, which was not really begun as a religious movement, but as a practical industrial movement.
Driving movement, essentially. The drunk driving movement, right?
Yes, right. Yeah.
No drinking and operating the machinery, no
that's
drinking
right.
And driving. Yeah. Huh.
But the beer had amounted to a nice mood-altering substance. It had been a source of calories to the people, and if you took that away, you had to substitute something for it. Well, caffeine was chosen as a compatible mood alterer for factory workers to use, and this introduced, tea and, to a lesser extent, coffee into Great Britain.
And then also that introduced international trade, too.
That's right. This brought in international trade, and the tea itself, while it gave you some caffeine, it was not a good source of calories, so you needed sugar to put in it. Or if we're sticking with beer and bread, it now became tea and bread, and then they wanted marmalade, or they wanted a sugary fruit spread to put on it. So this led to Great Britain becoming an international trade leader. They would get tea from China. They would get sugar from the Caribbean islands. It was the beginning of the triangle trade, where they took cloth and guns from England to Africa, traded it for slaves. Then they took the slaves to the sugar islands and traded that for sugar, rum, molasses, which they brought to the fledgling American colonies and back to Great Britain.
And we all know where all that went, right? Goodness sake. So, okay, back to modern technology. So we're getting pretty smart about, the growth and development of crops and using animals and equipment and machinery. But what about the crops itself? When did we really start getting into the development of smarter crops, smarter plants?
Well, the real scientific revolution began roughly around 1750. Darwin and Mendel started exploring what the plants were about. So there were a lot of advances in Europe about the need for nutrients and water and that type of thing. And then really it wasn't until the beginning of the 1900s when we started really looking at the tech Creasot's yield. And that included things like exploring the genetics of our plants and applying the fertilizer and getting water.
When we come back from this break, I'm going to ask you, Thomas, what's a good example of that breakthrough meant, of looking at the genetics of plants, and the example of how profoundly it changed our ability to develop civilization, I guess. Folks, this is A Food Chain, Michael Olson. We're talking with Thomas and Carol Sinclair, authors of Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change. You can call and participate if you want, 800-624-2665, 831-4791980. Right back. Well, the one thing we all know about agriculture is that it can be physically very demanding, and I guess the real change in the history of agriculture is when we got smart and learned how to use our brain and other things like equipment and genetics and fertilization and irrigation to supplant the physical labor and thus produce much more with much less physical labor. But of course, all of those things, those inputs, have a cost and they must be paid for. And that's the subject today, is can we pay for them? And will that technology that we pay for allow us to avoid the mistakes of our forebears and the collapse of their civilizations? So one of the most fascinating breakthroughs, I guess, in the intellectual pursuit of productive agriculture is the development of seeds and seed genetics. Right, Thomas?
Yes, of course. That was going on for 100 years. It started for a farmer. I mean, farmers have been doing it since the beginning. They would select out the strongest plant seeds from the strongest plants that had some desirable characteristics, and that's pretty well the way it went till about 1920.
Well, isn't that still the same thing we do? I mean, we search out favorable characteristics, and then we figure out how to make them grow?
Well, we do, but in the process, we guide the genetics of these plants by controlling the fertilization, the pollination of these plants. And so we're very much guiding the genetics that go into our current plants. The seed industry is based on controlling pollination and making sure we have the right parents to get the crop we want.
I was just going to say something about, don't you think we'd be smart if we were to do that with people? But I won't go there at all. And that's really the even today's, you know, genetic engineering, that's what we do, right?
This is an area that I've gotten in a bit of a controversy a bit, because the genetic engineer gives us a new source of genetic variation. The problem is it's so much at a very narrow level, just a segment of DNA, that it's hard to get its full expression to do much for us at the whole crop level. To be honest, that technology has kind of been stymied at that point. The two successes, or the major successes, really are focused on pests, mm-hmm. and not on just boosting the yield of the crop.
And why is that again?
Well, the plant has built over the eons a lot of redundancies in it. So if it's like a balloon, if you push it at one point, it kind of expands another point, and you really have no major impact on it. And the successes they've had with molecular genetics are they introduce, essentially, genetics are completely alien to the plant. They're dealing with alien chemicals, that is, those that help with the weed
right.
Situation or the insect situation. There really hadn't been anything that we can look at that's really changed the productivity capability.
We have done pretty good with our knowledge of fertilization, though, have we not?
Yes, that's been, from my point of view, that's been the change in agriculture. At the end of World War II, the yields were no, in the U.S., were no higher than they were in Great Britain. They were at that 2 tons per hectare. But all the munition plants that we had that produced ammonia nitrate for the bombs was now available and could be used directly and effectively as a fertilizer. And so the fertilizer applications in our fields just steadily climbed from about 1950 up to 1980, and as a result, a very nice parallel increase in yield. Of course, that was matched with plants that could effectively use that fertilizer.
So the genetics and the fertilization really caused, what, 5 times expansion in the
fertilizer? Essentially, yeah. Yeah, that's almost that amount of level in maize, almost that much in wheat, yeah.
Now, are we having to pay for some of the costs of fertilization?
Well, of course, one of the issues is that with these high levels of course, now I should say, after about 1980, farmers have not increased their amount of fertilization. It just was, it was diminishing returns, and economically it wasn't worth putting more on. And then there was a bit of an environmental cost because nitrogen is a very mobile material, and it doesn't make any difference what source it is. It moves, and one of the movements is into the environment around that field, getting into the groundwater, and it can get into streams, and the Mississippi rivers deposit a lot of nitrogen in the Gulf of Mexico, and we have a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
So none of these inputs that make our agriculture so productive are really without cost, and they all have a cost or a side effect that must be paid for one way or another, correct? Is that fair?
Well, it's pretty trite, but there is no free lunch.
I guess it's not very... It does stick, doesn't it? It just doesn't go away.
Yeah.
So what do you, in your way of thinking, as a crop scientist and as a historian, was the greatest breakthrough that we made?
Well, in terms of the direct impact, it was probably the ability to take an atmospheric nitrogen and put it into ammonia nitrate. Now, it was done by the Germans to build bombs. But to have that technology then that could be applied for fertilization really opened up the whole yield possibilities, basis for the yield increase in industrialized countries in rice and wheat.
And therein would be one great irony. That which was designed to blow us up actually lifts us up.
Well, that's curious. And the key insecticide that we use is from World War II.
Quick break here. We'll be right back with the big question. Can the technologies of our present prevent us from making the mistakes of our past? With Tom and Carol Sinclair and you right back. Well, folks, what do you think? Can the technologies that we have developed here in modern times for agriculture to increase the productivity of our agriculture to the extent that we now have these huge population centers that cities filled with people who have a time to run around and build sandcastles and do this and do that and shuffle paper from one side of the desk to the other? It's all made possible, of course, by a surplus of food. And without a surplus of food, things fall and fail, as discovered by the Sumerians of the Golden Triangle, the Egyptians of the Nile, the Chinese of the Yellow River, the Bantus of the African Plain, the Mayans of the Yucatan. Agriculture enabled them to develop great civilizations, but something happened to that agriculture, and sooner or later it just kind of withered and died because of the failure of agriculture. So Thomas and Carol Sinclair, authors of Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change, you know, you've looked at this and you at the history of agriculture, and you're very much involved with the present of agriculture, crop scientists. What do you think? Are we smart enough now to avoid the mistakes and the failures of the past? Carol, let's start with you.
Well, one thing that's very different now than has been at any time in the past is how little of our population is directly involved in producing food. We've let this become a very specialized minority. Less than 2% of the U.S. population is directly involved in food production. And we have more short-order cooks, like McDonald's cooks, than we have farmers. in some ways, I think this makes us vulnerable to natural disasters. It would be very difficult for most people to go back to the land and feed themselves because we've let these skills wither. We just don't have them anymore. We've produced children who know nothing about how to grow vegetables.
And don't know which end of a cow the milk comes from.
And don't know which end of a cow the milk. And hope that that milk just originates in the supermarket and doesn't have anything to do with animals.
No.
So this is definitely a danger point. But on the other hand, we've also stockpiled tremendous amounts of scientific knowledge. Tom, this is probably more your area.
Tom?
Yeah. Well, I have to be an optimist. I mean, being a crop scientist, I think we know a lot about what's going on.
Aren't all farmers optimists?
Well, that's the nature of that business, to be optimist. And I think we can, if we look at the perspective of the United States, we have the natural resources that I don't think running out of food for the U.S. itself is a problem. But as part of the global economy, that's where we, I think, have to be more concerned, because we have, even today, we have about 1 billion people that are really hungry, and something like 400,000 children die each day from malnutrition. So we have the problem today. It's not a new problem. It's just, what is the perspective from the U.S.? And I think we have to, I personally feel we have to take more of a global view of food production and how we make it available to others. But that, of course, that has all kinds of political implications and mm-hmm. economic implications that are beyond me.
I go along with both of you. I think we should think globally, but I also think we should think locally too. And I like the idea of somehow harboring the knowledge of how to grow our own locally and not relying on somebody that's in another part of the world to provide me with our food. But that's the nature of it, and I want to thank both of you for joining me for a couple weeks here on a tour of our history of agriculture. Thomas and Carol Sinclair, authors of Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change. Thank you both so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.